Hey there, really excited to have Sven Schnieders on my Total Bitcoin podcast show. He's a brilliant writer. He understands Bitcoin, the economical forces behind it, the principles. He's a really fascinating young man, 23-year-old, according to his own Twitter handle, who lives like a retiree, says, thinking during slow walks and writing essays in cafes. He learns about, goes into the rabbit hole of physics, quantum physics, he studies philosophy, and of course, Bitcoin. And check out his blog or website, limitlesscuriosity.com, where he writes brilliant essays and articles, which I've heard, Bitcoiners or investors or what have you are really impressed by his work. So really looking forward also to have him on the Value Bitcoin conference here in Vienna on March 5th, 2020, and during the panel discussions, which I'm going to also co-moderate. So without further ado, this is my interview with Sven Schnieders. We're going to talk about Bitcoin, Austin economics, technical aspects, critical adoption, and the fundamental questions, of this of this matrix we're living in. All right. So if you have any questions, let me know. And thanks so much for support and for listening.
Hey, Sven.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for your time. And I've been waiting for this interview for a long time so we can do this face-to-face in really highest quality format. So, Sven, you've made a pretty good impression on a lot of people, what I've heard.
Thanks.
A lot of known, whether it be investors, research analysts, Austin economists, Bitcoiners. So I'm going to start off, let's start off with your latest article. Unfortunately, I forgot the title of it, but it had to do with the fundamental properties. It was about the question, is I'm going to paraphrase it, whether gold, let's just start off with gold, can compete with Bitcoin. Is that right? Correct?
Yeah, it was definitely one of the main issues, let's say, that I wrote about in the essay. And I can try to quickly summarize what I tried to get across, and the fundamental question is why do we need Bitcoin, and why do we need to also run a full node and keep our own keys? That's basically the main question I tried to lay out, and the answers are basically monetary sovereignty and liberty. If these two things are important to you, then you will need Bitcoin. You will need to have your own keys. You will need to run your own node. That's basically the premise. And with how it relates to gold, it's basically the sovereign aspect of Bitcoin, mainly that you can run your own node. This is the biggest difference to gold. In gold, you can also transact with anyone. No one can tell you who to transact with, at least locally. But you cannot verify the gold you get. You don't know, is it real? How real is it? And for that, you need a quote-unquote gold node, which is obviously expensive. And you need the knowledge to verify it. And it's impossible in practice. So that's basically the biggest difference that I laid out in my essay, because Bitcoin lets you do that with an easy full node.
Sven, before we go into detail into the rabbit hole of, this whole economical monetary properties, why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, what's your journey to Bitcoin? Where do you find yourself?
So I'm 23 and I'm studying here in Vienna, but I got into Bitcoin basically when I was still living back in Germany, and I was I was into stocks and all that kind of stuff. And a friend of mine actually, like, kind of, I heard of Bitcoin and I watched some videos about it in, I think, back in 2016, start of 2017, I think. And yeah, but I didn't follow up on it, so I forgot about it. And then a friend of mine was into it and was into all the crypto market, let's say. And this was like end of 2017 when a lot of people got into it. And yeah, that's when I got into it as well. But it's from I started research end of 17, and then start of 18, let's say, I started getting really involved in it and reading a lot. And yeah, that's basically how I got into it, and how I got also then into Austrian economics and all the rabbit hole stuff with cypherpunk, privacy, security. I do have a lot of interests in, let's say, computer science, and I do some programming for fun. I'm not that great at it, but try my best. So that's basically where I come from and where my main interests lie, in the computer science and economic aspects and how they work together.
You have a pretty diversified spectrum, right, of passion, interests, and
That's yeah. I mean, I do just read a lot. I just read all day basically, and that's where you, that's how you find yourself in these diverse areas, I would say, if you're a curious person. And that's what my first essay I wrote about. It's about curiosity and how it relates to learning and stuff. So I'm really curious about a lot of things, and then I just read a lot of things and think about them. And then recently I've tried to write about them as well, because it helps you clarify all your thoughts, and you get really, yeah, you it's even for you personally, even if no one, like, no one thought my essays were any good and just didn't care, like, I would still be happy writing them, because it helps me a lot to think about, yeah, complicated topics like Bitcoin or physics, mathematics, computer science, philosophy, all of these kind of branches where I'm interested in.
which all those fields and beyond are indispensable for the comprehension of the overall holistic understanding of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. It's a lot. One interesting aspect of Bitcoin is that it is so difficult to understand because it has so many fields, and you can come from it from the economic side, which a lot of people do. A lot of people were Austrian economics first and then got into Bitcoin and saw it from this angle. But a lot of people also got into it from the, like, cypherpunk computer science route, and that's like, there's a lot of different things, where even with game theory and some psychology in it, and the incentives that work there, and which is, I guess, microeconomics. But there's a lot of different stuff to understand. That's why it's so, like, interesting to me, because every time you think, wait, I got this figured out, I know what's going on, you discover, no, there's a lot more to understand, basically.
Awesome. Sven, before we dive into the fundamentals of what is money, why do we need money, what is Bitcoin, why Bitcoin, can I just briefly ask you, do you think it's time for individually and as a society and civilization as a whole to question the very fundamentals? No, let me rephrase it, the fundamental legitimacy of nation state, government regimes, banks, central banks, or every centralized structure you can think of. Not only ethically, but really constitutionally, legitimate wise.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question, and I do think it's kind of getting to the point where a lot of people, a lot more people, are seeing that most institutions and even like normal big bureaucracy, like all of this kind of stuff, like organizing, centralizing, planning society or any big project for that matter, are failing a lot basically, and they don't deliver on anything. They don't do any good. So I do think that a lot of people are seeing that, and I do think Bitcoin helps in this overall scheme of things, that people can realize there is another way to doing things. There is a decentralized way. Bitcoin has shown that, or Bitcoin is continuing to show that with money. And I do think money is, for me, the most important part of this whole puzzle, let's say, of centralized nation states and how to deal with that problem of governance and how to, let's say, govern people. But for people that are, let's critical of the nation state and want to, whatever, destroy or take it down or fragment it, whatever the goals are, I do think Bitcoin is the best way to start, because you can shout at people all you want and say to the government that they should be small or they should do X or Y, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen in a way Bitcoin does it, where you just stop paying them. They don't have any money, they don't create any real value for people, and that's how this whole structure is likely going to fall, in my opinion. And that's why I'm also not a big activist at all, because I don't see any value in it. It's pretty difficult to vote for someone you think shouldn't have the job in the first, that shouldn't be his job. So it's all pretty difficult, but I'm glad Bitcoin gives us this great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Let me go a little bit deeper. Do you think once the parameters, the conditions are set, you know, externally and the environmental, you know, monetary economical conditions that we have, once Bitcoin, as they call it, ossifies, you know, as I would call it, the monetary root layering, you know, becomes rooted, do you think that the political structures and all the other, you know, the circus around it could become obsolete, like governmental structures, not in totality, but substantially, become obsolete?
I completely think that. I do see people underestimating, in my opinion, obviously, how much is going to change if we had a different, or if we had a hard money like Bitcoin. And
what makes it so hard? Explain to our listeners, what is hardness? What are the fundamentals of
it? Yeah, all right. So let's try to get into it a little bit. So hard money basically means that you cannot make, like, what we have now is just some money, but it's, you can print infinite amount of money. And the property of hard money is it's difficult to create. It's hard to create more of it. So that's Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a fixed supply, 21 million, and there ain't gonna be a single more Bitcoin than that. So that's extremely hard. People are always talking a lot about gold, which is also extremely hard, because you can only dig up a certain amount of gold in, let's say, a year. And this is a really small amount compared to the supply, which is already there, like circulating. And that's where also the stock to flow ratio, which has gotten really popular, comes from. So basically you need a high stock and a low flow, meaning a low new supply each year or each month. And that will make money hard.
So gold has a relative scarcity.
Yeah, it's really hard, but it's obviously not as hard or as difficult, let's say, to create as Bitcoin. Right now it is more difficult, but after the next halving, the block reward gets cut and Bitcoin is going to be the hardest money, or it's going to be with the highest stock to flow ratio, let's say.
Okay. In order to understand the potential, the real potential of Bitcoin, where do we start? What's the misconception? Why is it so hard for most people to understand the really fundamental properties, monetary properties of, you know, of hard money, of hardest money?
I think the biggest problem is that people just don't see that need. They just don't know what they're missing, basically, or don't know how bad the monetary system actually is, because it's it's a catastrophe, and it's really basically all the banks do and stuff. It's people don't realize how much that contributes to their situation as individuals, and that basically if people keep on printing money and this money is not going to be distributed equally, for example, like those who are close to banks and high up in whatever institution prints money, they're gonna get the money first. They're gonna be rich, let's say, and until this money is distributed to all people, it's the person who gets it last is going to be the worst. Like for him, it's not going to be great. He doesn't have anything to gain from this printing of money. So that's, I think, the seeing this fundamental, let's say, injustice, in my opinion, is for me one of the biggest reasons I'm so bullish and so grateful about Bitcoin, because I hope and I do think that this is going to change, and that's a great thing.
Now, I wrote a couple of articles, not so famous as yours, but about, you know, Bitcoin versus central banks, and because I really went into the also history, the, let's just call it, criminal history of the International Bank for Bank for International Settlements. Now, before we dive into the technical requirements, you know, or user-friendly, you know, question, what would you say to a potential noob or Bitcoin beginner? You know, let's say, you know, the curiosity is there, you know, you find an open-minded person who says, okay, let me try this out. First of all, what would you say to this person, to this noob? Why?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question, obviously, and I don't know if I'm the best person to like talk to noobs about it, because for me it's sometimes difficult to understand how people think that are basically not that far into it, let's say. But I would definitely, like, I'm a big fan of Saifedean Ammous's book for this reason, because it's really the history of money, and then in the end it's some Bitcoin, and it's not starting with Bitcoin and how awesome Bitcoin is and all the technicalities and everything. It's basically starting with why we need it and what happened in the past, as you said. And I think that's a really great place to start. If someone is curious, just give them this book, and hopefully they will see what I saw, let's say, when I read this book. And also, without being like too much fanboying for myself, but I hope my article helps as well if you're starting out and don't know why everyone is so grateful for this liberty and sovereignty that we get with using Bitcoin, then I hope my article or my essay helps there and shows you why you need that too, and why you would want something like Bitcoin, and why you need to run a node and need to hold your own keys. So that's basically how I would start.
In progressive phases, like, you know, old Bitcoiners or OG Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoiners who have been here in this space for a long time. And it's true. I mean, it used to be really hard, difficult to get your hands on Bitcoin, right? I mean, it used to be really difficult. You had to be, I don't know, go Mt. Gox and then went to, you know,
true,
got
yes.
hacked or whatever. And you had to really have some technical skills. But nowadays, let's just say buying Bitcoin and hodling Bitcoin is pretty self-explanatory. Would you say just for hodling, just for buying and hodling, that's it?
I mean, it's definitely gotten a lot easier, and this is definitely important. Buying, obviously, using the Cash App, for example, to just dollar cost average Bitcoin is really easy. Anyone can do it. Hodling Bitcoin is in the easiest sense obviously not difficult. There are some problems though with doing it the right way, let's say, meaning doing it secure and doing it hopefully also in a more private way than just buying it on Coinbase, and worst case scenario letting it on Coinbase, but second worst just putting it on a hardware wallet, which is fine for beginners obviously, but I just hope that people who understand it more and more see why just having it on Coinbase or just not caring about privacy is bad, and we need to change that as, let's say, as a community, and to try to educate like the new people on these important things. So no one can obviously expect them to understand everything at first and just use Wasabi wallet, mix their coins with their first buy. No one's going to do that, but it should be a progressive thing, like getting people first to take their Bitcoin off the exchange, and then, oh, maybe I should coin join, maybe I should care about privacy, maybe I should use a different hardware wallet, a more secure one, and all of these kind of things.
Because it's really not easy, right? I mean, user experience, user interface, it's so important. The features, the operations that could maybe eventually become more and more by default without having, this required thinking process. And really, you got to take care of a lot of in-between steps, right?
Yes,
Especially
yes.
setting up your node or coin mixing, coin joining for most people. I mean,
Yeah, I would agree. It's really difficult for most people, especially for people that don't have, let's say, the little programming background where I'm coming from, with some like Python coding and stuff, and using command lines is for me not difficult, but for most people it's obviously really hard, and this needs to change, because even nowadays if you use a mixing service or if you use, let's say, Wasabi, you need to look out for a lot of things. You need to know about coin control, you need to not reuse your address, you need to not mix when you spend unmixed and coin joined coins, and you need to, it's not easy. You need to take care of a lot of things, and this is hopefully soon going to be automated as much as possible, obviously. And I'm definitely grateful for anyone doing the work there. But as I've already tried to kind of outline in my essay, is that this is only half of the work. Technical improvements are great, especially when it comes to user experience, but the other half is telling people how important it is to care for those things, so they invest the energy, they invest the time to learn about them, to, oh, maybe I look up what coin control means, what are UTXOs and stuff. Sure, everything is going to get easier, but there's still going to be some burden on people to just do it themselves, learn it themselves. It's not going to be completely without effort, let's say.
You mentioned auto DCA, that's auto automatic dollar cost averaging. It took me a while till I understood the term because I thought always it's relative to a certain time period that you measure. Within a week, a month, you look at the price, but it just means a regular
Yes.
accumulation. It doesn't matter what the price, right?
Yeah, the
And
point is the you just accumulate over time, basically. You just buy whatever, like every Saturday you buy what, $50 of sats, let's say,
automatically.
automatically, and you don't touch it. That's the most important point, that you just don't do
Don't
anything.
trade.
You don't trade, don't try to time it. You can dollar cost average, let's say, and then if you think the price is super low
Buy
today,
a bigger chunk,
buy a
right?
bigger chunk, let's say, but don't do this kind of, don't try to time it too much, let's say. And that's really where, I mean, stacking sats is becoming a bigger thing. And that's great, because that's what people, especially new people, should do, because no one knows what's going to happen with the price. So just keep accumulating, keep buying, and in certain intervals, and you're gonna do great.
Exactly. And shout out to Hess McCook, who has been advocating out of DCA for such a long time and proving, you know, by with numbers, right? By calculating for people who would have been, you know, out of DCAing or accumulating over time, that they're always better off, you know, than people who are just constantly whatever, you know, selling, buying, and you know, trading.
Yeah, it's really, those analyses are really showing that it's extremely difficult to be better than just buying every week. It's really difficult. You need to hit those couple of days where Bitcoin is really cheap. You get a lot of sats for your weird USD or whatever you had got. And I wouldn't recommend it. I don't trade anymore. I kind of used to, as I said. I don't do it anymore. I don't think, especially for new people, they should even think about it. Just buy regular amount, DCA, stack sats, but invest your time in education. Don't invest your time in learning how to trade. Invest your time to learn how to Bitcoin, basically, and not some other stuff.
So, what would you do? What would you say to a noob, you know, how to, you know, get the first taste? What would be like the first really technical? Would it be a mobile wallet for now, like a Blockstream Green wallet, or get yourself, you know, would you prefer, like, would you recommend definitely, you know, one or two? I mean, all of the exchanges are KYC, right? So, non-KYC, it's either really difficult or, I don't know, to
Yeah.
operate. And what's a full node? Why a full node again?
Yeah, I mean, so for a new person, let's say, coming into it, I don't think you should worry that much about, let's say, like, know your customer laws and all of that stuff on exchanges, because, as you said, all of the big ones, at least all of the ones where a new person's going to buy Bitcoin, they are KYC. So I think it's best to just get him into it at first. It's the easiest way. If it's Coinbase, if it's Cash App, whatever, then they have some Bitcoin, then they have, like, skin in the game, let's say. And then you can try to educate them on how to do it better next time. How to, like, not use, maybe use BISC, which is pretty advanced, but you can try. I don't think it's really a reasonable expectation to convince people before they, like, buy their first Bitcoin or something to, like, you have to do it this way, you have to use BISC, you cannot do this. This is gonna scare a lot of people, and I don't think it's a great way. I think you should do it, like, progressively, get them into it, get them to buy something, and then educate them how to do it better next time, how to do this, how to run your own node, and all of these things. But it takes time. You cannot expect anyone to, like, just do everything right the first time. That's just how it goes.
I mean, I'm a big fan of, you know, of all those plug and play stuff. So, Casa, you know, shout out to Casa. I mean, I have myself a Casa too now. It took me a while because it still had some, you know, technical problems or, you know, internet connection, or you have to reboot it. So, but it's still a plug and play full node, and you get yourself like a multi-sig. So, you know, it's an additional security layer instead of just putting it on a hardware wallet. Now again, why a full node? What do you need a full node for?
Yeah, so that's where we get deep into it. So, full node, for those people who, let's say, don't know, is the full transaction history of Bitcoin. Meaning, from the first transaction in the first block, which is the Genesis block, you get all the transactions, which is a lot of data, and you verify every single one by yourself on your own PC, that it fits, basically, that it follows all the rules, let's say. And if you've done that and take some time, you can then verify all transactions that come in. They are broadcasted basically in the Bitcoin network, that they fit your rules, that they don't, let's say, that the miner who mined the block didn't say, "Oh, I want more Bitcoin for my mined block. Let's give me 100 Bitcoin reward. How about that?" No, you got your own node, you got your own rules, and you're only going to accept those transactions and those blocks that confirm to all the rules you have agreed to basically by running the software. You can run the software however you want, which is something we are probably going to get into it later, but a lot of people don't understand. You can do whatever you want. You can change the software whatever you want. You can change all the rules. No one cares. It's your node and you decide. But if you change the rules in a weird way, let's say that is not compatible with everyone else, you are not part of the network anymore. So you don't get all the benefits of being part of it. So that's basically what a full node lets you just do everything by yourself, verify everything, and lets you basically claim, as I've said, your monetary sovereignty, which is you don't have to trust anyone else. You just trust your own node, listen to your own node, and that's it.
So it means this is the process or the path to becoming a totally self-sovereign Bitcoiner, or you know, taking real control and self-responsibility. I think it's a huge challenge for a lot of people, especially when it comes to securing your own private keys, you know, taking care of your own privacy, security, and validating events, essentially with your full node, self-validating every transaction and the principles of Bitcoin, right?
I mean, yeah, I do. It's a huge step for a lot of people, and it's, I think, where the distinction for me comes in from people that are just Bitcoin investors and, let's say, quote-unquote real Bitcoiners, people that care about the values that are sovereignty and liberty in the monetary sense, obviously. And this is where, in my opinion, as I've said, the education comes in. You need to explain to people why it is so important to be sovereign and to have the liberty, to have the freedom to transact with anyone. Because if you, let's say, have your Bitcoin on an exchange, you cannot transact with anyone. You have to first take it off, and then, let's say you have it on your hardware wallet, then you can transact with anyone you want. No one's going to tell you what transaction to send to whom. But if you have it on Coinbase, they might ask you to identify yourself, let's say, or as we've seen in the past, exchanges don't like it if you send your Bitcoin to Wasabi wallet because they think it's evil or they don't want anything to do with it. There are a lot of weird stuff going on. So if your Bitcoin lies on an exchange, as the let's say popular saying goes, not your keys, not your coins. So it is not your coins. It is not your money when it's lying on an exchange. You have to ask permission from the exchange. And it is important to understand why you want this freedom to transact with anyone, because most people, especially living in all the Western countries in America or Germany or Austria, where we are in right now, people obviously think they have the freedom to transact with anyone. It doesn't happen all the time that the bank says, no, I don't want you to do transaction X or whatever. But it does happen sometimes, and those cases are pretty severe. And as I've tried to lay out a couple of times already, it's stuff like WikiLeaks, let's say, where Visa and MasterCard and PayPal are just shutting down all transactions to WikiLeaks and trying to basically silence them from publishing and trying to basically censor them that way, which this is all the examples like this are the reasons you need this freedom. You need to hold your own keys so that you can transact with anyone, because if you need to ask permission, it's not your money.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a big fan also of the Samurai wallet, you know, with its Whirlpool coinjoin. Now they are, you know, right now working on implementing or integrating the mobile mixing, right? So it's going to become easier. It's privacy technology is going to become more easier, and especially it's going to become the sort of the coin, the mixed coins, going to become sort of indistinguishable from the non-mixed ones. So, I mean, then especially when our attitude collectively changes, like we should actually take care of a private, we should coin mix. So
yeah, I agree. It's getting a lot, especially on the privacy front, which is, in my opinion, probably one of the bigger challenges, let's say, for Bitcoin facing it right now. It's getting a lot better. A lot of things are getting done by Samurai or Wasabi. And it is important to get a lot of people into it because, as you've said, if a lot of people have also pointed out that if only some portion of people mix and use CoinJoin, it's not really great for those who do, because everyone can see right now, basically, if you CoinJoin or which transaction are CoinJoin transactions, and people are saying like, oh, I don't want those coins, they are CoinJoin, this is going to be some illegal stuff or whatever people say. So that's difficult. But when everyone uses CoinJoin regularly, or every transaction is a CoinJoin, basically, that's not going to be a problem. And people will have to, let's say, accept those coins, and that's going to be great.
And then it's becoming like fungible, right? Like real cash. And then, you know, you can't say this is tainted, this is not tainted. I mean, it's total bullshit, right? So Samurai also has this Ricochet function where there's like hops, it's like unlinking, like bring more distances, right? I mean, can you elaborate?
Yeah, it's basically the problem which a lot of people have pointed out is, if let's say you're an exchange and you say you don't want any coins who are coin joined, well, what does it mean? How big has to be the gap basically between the last coin join and when you get the coins? Because let's say I'm someone who doesn't coin join, and I just want to send my Bitcoin to Binance, but the guy before me who sent me my coins for the work I did, let's say, coin joined, and then Binance says, yeah, well, we don't take coin joined coins, but obviously it's not my thing, I didn't coin join, I just got the coins. And that's basically the whole premise or the whole problem, and that's how you get exchange. That's basically how you can, quote unquote, fool exchanges. You just do some hops in between. You just coin join and do just some self send. You just send your coins over and over to yourself, obviously not reusing addresses. And yeah, then there's no point in saying they were coin joined. You can just, especially with the fees right now, you can just do 20 transactions in between, at best with some random intervals and random times and even random fees if you want to be really secure. And then no one can, there's no clear cut line. If the exchange says, yeah, we don't take coins that are coin joined in the last whatever 12 transactions, you just do 15 transactions and your coin doesn't count as coin joined anymore. So there's a lot of things people can do, and obviously software developers are doing to combat this kind of weird tainted Bitcoin scenario. And it's gonna get a lot easier, I think, and it's definitely needed. That's what I would say.
All right, so before we transition again, maybe going back to, you know, the misconception when it comes to also to gold, you know, the gold bugs, any other like technical, operational, privacy, security aspects you think it's important to communicate?
You mean in the difference between gold and
no, just Bitcoin? For Bitcoin, just for the, you know, for this progressive phases of buying, hodling, security, privacy.
I think the most important things is just that you hold your own keys and that you run your own node, and then you can worry about privacy and obviously security and how to do that all safe. But getting people to basically take responsibility, which is what it is about, for their own situation, their monetary situation, their monetary life, let's say, is the first and most important point, and that's where a lot of what I try to communicate starts, basically. That's what I try to tell people, that they need to take responsibility and show why they can't just let anyone else do. Yeah, I'm gonna let this bank control my money, or this exchange, it's fine. I don't have to worry about all of this stuff. And so that's where I focus a lot, let's say. And it's also, I do think that some people, maybe especially people who are really not technical at all, especially right now, shouldn't hold their own keys. I agree definitely with that. And it might be even the case in the future that are people that shouldn't hold their own keys, because they will lose whatever, they would make all sorts of mistakes, let's say. But these people should at least know the trade-offs that come with it. They should know, if I don't hold my own keys and if I don't run my own node, what are the trade-offs? What am I missing out? And what am I basically, the ease of use that I'm gaining from letting the bank or the exchange hold my coins, is it worth it or isn't it? And that's basically the decision everyone has to do by themselves, but I want to try to make it in a really informed decision. That's all basically.
So there's services like, Nux Custody. I interviewed Tibu Marechal, so they provide or, offer insured, let's say what's called, I don't know, semi-custodial services with multi-sig. So you don't, you're still not, in custodial service, but you have 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5 keys, or like in Casa, you've got, 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5. What's your take on that?
I do think it can be great, and I do think what people are trying to do at Casa is definitely a great option between completely doing it on your own and completely letting someone else do it. There are some, I'm more critical than most, I would say, about all of the solutions, because people, the theory behind it is great. The problem is the practicality. And the problem is really how to verify that the person they hand the keys out to is the person who the keys belong to, basically. So how do you identify yourself? Is it fine to just go there with your ID and show them that? Or what's if a person stole your ID and stuff? That, all some of the things people have to think about a lot more, in my opinion. And they're not that hand wavy, let's say, to get rid of. But I support every, let's say, innovation there is in the space, and everyone trying out new things, and everyone trying to make it easier to hold and basically get Bitcoin. But I'm more, obviously, for myself and for the people I know, more of a fan of doing everything by yourself, just being completely self-sovereign, knowing how everything works, and that's basically my journey.
Yeah, I'm definitely advocating also for. I mean, I think these services are innovative entrepreneurs or companies like Casa. I think they're trying, first of all, make it easy, user friendly, and prevent sort of the worst case scenario. Instead of losing it totally, at least you have, if you lose one key, then you still can recover with whatever, your mobile wallet and or your the other hard wallet, or if you it's 3 out of 5 or whatever, right? So it's sort of a trade-off, right? It's sort of a balanced trade-off, I think they're trying to achieve.
I agree, and I do think it's definitely great what they try to do. I would say that they should maybe communicate more the difficulties that I've lined out, and maybe also like for whom these services are really for, and how much money you should basically maybe let in those services, or like just say put half, let's say, with Casa in this multisig, and do half yourself, or like any of those things. I don't think you should do everything with Casa, but it's really a difficult decision that everyone has to do on their own and with their own situation, own technical knowledge. And I really appreciate what they're trying to do as entrepreneurs, it's obviously great.
Great. Okay, let's go back to, you know, there's, I had those guests also on, Dr. Markus Kral, Dr. Thorsten Polleit. These are really amazing, brilliant Austrian economists, libertarian, free market advocates, mm-hmm. but, you know, strong advocates and, you know, of the gold standard. What is it that, what would be the common denominator between the Bitcoiners and gold bucks or gold advocates or free market, gold market, gold standard?
Bitcoiners and gold bucks obviously like discuss a lot and bash each other all the time, let's say, but there's a lot of common ground we have. Basically, what we have alluded to in the beginning, the hard money, and that we need to take the control basically for money out of the banks, or let's say out of the like government more specifically, so they can't just print more and more money. And that's basically a lot of common ground we have, and also that inflation is not really needed that much as, for example, Keynesian think, and all of this stuff is really, really clear to all of those people. But there are the devils in the detail, basically. So how to achieve those things that we all agree on, and why we need gold, or in my example, Bitcoin for it, is where we differ, and we differ a lot on that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. If we went through a checklist of the monetary properties, or you know, properties in general, where do you see like fundamental differences or commonality?
I do think the commonalities are obviously that what I've alluded to as the low stock to flow ratio, basically being a hard money, they're both really hard. Bitcoin is going to be, as we've said already, harder after the next halving.
But it is like the higher the stock to flow ratio, right? Because there was there was even twice or three times a mistake. He's going to be corrected in the next version. I was actually the first one who said that he Safir Damouz made that mistake. He mixed it up. Instead of saying higher or highest or whatever, he said lower. So it's actually the higher the stock to flow ratio, the harder it is, right? Just for clarification.
I think so, yes.
Because the stock to flow ratio, for example, of gold is approximately 58 to 60. So, and Bitcoin will supersede, will, you know, exceed that stock
to flow ratio. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. Yeah, my bad. True, yeah. Yeah, so basically, this stock to flow and the focus on that, basically the focus on hard money, it is a commonality of Bitcoin and gold. But the most obvious difference is the digital nature of Bitcoin solves a lot of problems gold has. And this is what I think people who are gold bugs or advocating for gold don't realize, that this digital nature solves first of the storage problem that gold suffers a lot from, meaning if you want to self-store your gold, obviously you can do it, but it gets difficult, especially with large quantities. It's really not practical to secure them all by your own, and it's costly to do it, and they can get stolen pretty easy. Like it's not great. And that's the first big problem. So there you need a bank, basically. You need someone to hold them in a big secure vault for you. And that's the first big difference that gets solved through the digital nature of Bitcoin. And the second, in my opinion, big difference is the verification aspect. I've already kind of talked about it. You cannot in practice verify if you get gold that it is that is just real gold. And with Bitcoin, you can do it. Just run your own full node and it's fine. With gold, you cannot do it. And that's a big problem. And people, gold bugs, obviously say you wouldn't trade gold on the street. And that's obviously true. You would trade let's say, banknotes backed by gold as we've had already in the past. But the problem still remains the same, then you cannot verify that those banks really have gold. And if you, let's say, go to the bank and tell them you want your gold back, if you're lucky, they will give it to you. But even then, we are back at the verification problem. You need to go to someone else, ask them, yo, is this real? Is this what I've got real? And all of those things get solved, in my opinion, elegantly through Bitcoin and its digital nature and the full node process, basically.
Right, and you have the problem with gold that, yeah, how do you, as you said, you know, how are you going to assay or validate the purity, the authenticity of the gold? Unless, of course, you know, we'd have an app that you can, you know, reliably trust a technology that everybody can at any time validate the whatever 99.99% purity of gold. But otherwise, I have to go to a certified gold dealer merchant, trust that his technology, his whatever apparatus, machine is, you know, that gives you like the results that you have to trust upon, right? He's going to tell you, yeah, it's, you know, whatever, you know. So it's a lot of practical difficulties
it's
here.
It's really,
right?
People are, and I think it's kind of maybe not dishonest, but it's definitely getting close to it when people who are advocating for gold like hand wave all of these problems. It's really not an easy problem to solve, and I don't think it's solvable just because of the nature of gold, let's say, and the properties that come with it. So that's basically why I think we need Bitcoin. And I mean, the argument most gold people have against Bitcoin is obviously that it's really experimental. It's new. No one basically knows what's going on, and that's true. And gold is, let's say, time tested, but what most people are missing basically is that, yeah, gold is time tested, but it has failed. That's basically per definition what happened, because otherwise we would be on the gold standard right now, and we are not. That's basically where gold failed. And
we also had confiscation. I mean, it's, you know,
yeah,
history could repeat
it
itself.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. People who are saying gold has been around for a long time and advocating for it, they have a point in the sense that the value is, let's say, more stable than Bitcoin. But if we talk about time tested, it has failed in the past. Otherwise, we would be using gold backed notes right now if there were not these big problems of centralization that come with the physical properties of gold. And that's where I would point people who are really into gold to basically look at the history, look what happened. And then people like Peter Schiff, for example, who have their own solutions with their vaults of gold and sending them digitally, basically just sending the ownership digitally, thinking that's an easy solution to the problem, don't realize that the real problem is not the usability, let's say, with running around with a gold in your hand. That's easy to solve. The problem is decentralization, that you cannot decentralize gold, basically. That's the thing. And as we've seen in the past, that leads to the government confiscating it, or just showing up at your door or the bank's door with a lot of guns, and then it's getting difficult.
So to wrap this up, if you would zoom out, where do you see Bitcoin going in the next 10 years? When you look at the macro environment, the coronavirus or COVID-19 as it's called, the negative interest rate, the quantitative easing, all these devastating things that are going on.
I mean, it's really difficult. I don't like to make like too specific predictions about the future, because basically no one knows what's going on in the present even, and then obviously no one knows what's happening in the future. But there are some things you can definitely bet on breaking, as Nassim Taleb obviously alludes a lot to. things that are fragile going to break in the long run, and I do think that's going to happen. So quantitative easing, all of this inflation stuff and hyperinflation, as we've seen in Venezuela, it's going to get a lot, we're going to see a lot more of this kind of stuff. All of this mismanagement, all of this printing money can obviously not go on forever. Everyone knows that, basically everyone, even people working at banks, kind of know it. They just don't care, basically. And I do think that all of this is going to break down in the next 10 years, definitely. And that people are going to see the need for Bitcoin, basically. So why do we need Bitcoin? They're seeing it with their own eyes. This is what people who lived their childhood in countries where hyperinflation was a big thing, you don't need to explain to those people why we need Bitcoin. They saw it with their own eyes that you cannot let government have control of it, because it's going to be hyperinflation. They're going to print money as much as they can, and this is going to be a bad outcome. So when this happens more and more, and it's probably going to happen, or very likely going to happen, in a lot of Western countries, Europe, America, then we are going to see the same thing. People don't need basically that education that we are trying to give them. We are trying to warn them right now, telling them it's bad if they have control. It's going to get to hyperinflation, or it's going to crash the economy. And some people are obviously listening, and that's great, and they can save themselves by buying Bitcoin right now. But if it's all going to happen, and if some country starts and everything, let's say, breaks down, it doesn't have to be that dramatic, but it's going to be not pretty, I think. And then we don't have to tell people anymore. They're going to see, yeah, we need a reliable store of value. What can I do to save me, and Bitcoin is hopefully going to be ready for this big challenge to come.
And as it's called, asymmetric uncorrelated asset, it's like, what do you have to lose, right? If you just put a minimal percentage of whatever, for institutional investors, ultra not high worth individuals, like 1 or 2 or whatever percent, as a, what do we call it, safe haven, bet, hedge, or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's an easy decision, basically, because if anything goes wrong with the current monetary system, you still have Bitcoin, basically. And that's what most people should do, and that's what betting, being bullish on Bitcoin, is being bearish on all the monetary policy of government and Federal Reserve, basically. So if you like what they're doing, keep buying stocks, keep your US dollar. But if you don't like what they're doing and think it's kind of fishy, invest in Bitcoin, at least a little of your savings, and then if things get serious, you can see the need for more, you can buy more. And that's, I think, a great way to start.
Great, wonderful. I really enjoyed this talk. Sven, why don't you, in conclusion, tell my listeners where they can find you, your resources, your links, and any other information you want to give my listeners?
Yeah, so basically you can just find me on Twitter at Sven Schnieders. I'm sure it's going to be in the show notes.
Definitely.
Or something like that. And you can find, I have a website where I publish my essays. It's called limitlesscuriosity.com. Kind of my...
Sounds like a movie, huh?
I mean, it's my motto, let's say. I'm really curious, so that's what I write about. And yeah, that's all you can do. If you're in Vienna, you can come to the meetup I organized, Bitcoin Vienna. It can also be found on Twitter.
And on Telegram.
That's the Telegram group. Yeah, that's it, I would say.
All right. Looking forward to seeing you at the Value of Bitcoin conference.
Oh,
also,
yeah, right,
it's
right.
Be a
yeah,
really fascinating, because there's going to be an ex-member of the European Central Bank there. So, yeah, it's going to be a very
True.
Fruitful discussion.
If you're in Vienna listening, you can come to the Value of Bitcoin
on March 5th, 2020 in Palais Esterhazy or whatever. So we'll put those in the show
notes. See me there debate some gold bugs and hopefully convince them that Bitcoin is the way better technology.
Definitely. Bitcoin is monetary evolution. I mean, there's nothing to change that. So thank you so much again, Sven. And
thank you. Talk to you soon.
Hey there. So how'd you love my talk with Sven Schnieders? I really enjoyed it. It really really capable of breaking down things. Also, you know, when it comes to explaining things, terminology, especially for noobs, for Bitcoin beginner, anybody who's open-minded and curious, right? So make sure you check out his website, his blog, limitlesscuriosity.com, put it in the show notes and give him a follow. Share, like, subscribe, retweet, whatever you do, please help me in any shape or form. If you're an ethical Bitcoin sponsor, get in touch with me, hello@thetotalconnector.com. And yeah, looking really forward to seeing Sven during the panel discussion, which I'm going to co-moderate, and all of you, any of you, any of your Bitcoiners, if you're nearby, you know, drop by the symposium in Vienna on March 5th, 2020. If you want a discount off the regular price, is Connector 20. And yeah, really excited to, you know, have Sven on again. It was a brilliant talk, fascinating insights, and hope we can repeat this in the very near future with other topics into the rabbit hole of Bitcoin. All right. My name is Kevan Devani. This is Total Bitcoin.